guess you all know what my topic is. I'm going to be talking about a health issue. I'm going to be talking about cancer, and I'm going to be especially talking about an alternative treatment for cancer, more commonly known as Laetril, a very controversial substance that was very much in the news back in the 1970s when I first became involved in it. The mission that I have today is to put together a couple of rather major topics into one, hopefully a shorter version of the what could actually be a whole day seminar if we had the stamina for it, or the intelligence, both of which we are lacking. So what I'm going to be talking about is the politics of cancer therapy, primarily, but before we do that, I'll be talking a little bit about the science of cancer therapy also. And before I do that, I don't want to run the risk of having it slip my mind. I'd like to introduce and acknowledge my wife, Patricia, right sitting right here. And it's especially significant that I should do that, not only because it's pretty rare that she gets to go along. She doesn't say it, but I know she thinks that she hears me talk enough. She doesn't have to come out here to do more of it. But she has plenty else to do, that's the truth. But it's significant today because on this topic, Pat is an author and an expert on her own right. She has written a book, co-authored it with Dr. John Richardson, M.D., who's now deceased. But Dr. Richardson had a cancer clinic, a very thriving cancer clinic up in the San Francisco area in the 70s when all of this was transpiring. And Pat went up and assisted him in pulling together all of the patient records from his clinic. And after many months of working on those records and interviewing patients and pulling it all together, we published a book called Laetril Case Histories, and she's the co-author of that. We have some of the copies of her book here in case you're interested. I know she'd be happy to autograph them, and you'd be very impressed by what's in there. These are real case histories of real people. This is not just theory. I'll be talking about theory shortly, but in her treatise, we're talking about actual results, and you can't argue with that. So, okay. I have a lot of ground to cover, so we'll get right to it. I look back on all of this history, and it seems like it happened 1,000 years ago to me, and I remember the first time I ever heard the word Laetril was in the summer of 1971. I mentioned Dr. John Richardson a moment ago. He was a good friend of ours, and occasionally I would get together with Dr. John, and we'd sort of get out of town and get away from the telephones and the usual helter-skelter of business and go off and pretend like we were hunting or something like that. We never did any hunting. My father was a fisherman. I've never done any fishing. But anyway, it was a good cover story just to get away. We'd go up into Northern California or possibly Oregon, and we'd just take some time off and look at the beautiful countryside and enjoy it. Well, this one particular occasion, I knew I was in trouble. There was something different because John brought his briefcase with him. That was almost like an unmentionable, unforgivable sin. You don't bring your briefcase on these trips. But he brought his briefcase with him, and soon I found out that the reason he did that is that he'd gotten into trouble with the local medical authorities because he was using an unapproved substance in the treatment of his cancer patients. And the story that he told me was kind of astounding. He said that he had been introduced to this substance. It was called Laetril. He didn't know anything about it, but he didn't have much faith in it because, after all, it wasn't approved. It didn't come from the medical establishment, and he certainly didn't know anything about it from his education. But somebody said that it was very effective, and he should try it. He was not having particularly good results in treating cancer patients, pretty much the same story as most doctors. And he said, well, I'll give anything a try. And so he had a dog that has cancer, and there was no way to cure the dog. The dog was not responding to any of the orthodox treatments, and they were going to have to put the animal down. So he thought, well, let's give it a try. And much to his amazement, the dog recovered. It didn't take very long before one of the nurses on his staff, who had a member of the family with incurable cancer, came to him and said, "Look, I saw what this did with the dog. Can we try it on the member of my family?" And he said, "Well, I don't know whether we dare do that or not. She said, what have we got to lose? This person is not going to make it anyway." So they tried it, and the patient recovered. So there were two rather dramatic instances in his life which made him go back and take a very serious look at this thing called Laetrile. And he met the inventor, the discoverer, Dr. Ernst T. Krebs, Jr., had many conferences with him, became familiar with the theory, the science behind it, and began to cautiously use it in his practice. And he went from a terrible loss rate, I guess you would call it that, where he was losing most of his patients that he was treating with cancer. He went from that to a high success rate almost overnight by using this substance. And so he became very enthusiastic about it. The word got around. His patients were very happy, of course, and they told their friends. It wasn't very long before people were coming from all over the United States, and in some cases even from Europe, to be treated at the Richardson Clinic. Then he got into trouble with the medical authorities. The hospital administration contacted him and said, "You have to stop using this material because it is not approved by the FDA. And he said, "Yeah, I know it's not approved, but it works." They said, "We don't care whether it works or not. It is not an approved substance, and you're in violation of the law." Dr. John was a very principled person. He had his Hippocratic Oath, which he felt very strongly about. He wanted to save lives. He had to choose between bucking the establishment, risking his own license, or saving lives. And so he chose the path that only he could have taken. He decided to fight for the right, for the truth, and to treat his patients with Laetrile. That's where I entered the picture. I didn't know any of that was going on until this trip, and he had his briefcase with all of these papers and diagrams and things. He said, "You know what I want you to do, Ed, since you're a communicator, supposedly, and I'm a doctor," he said, "why don't you communicate this idea? I'd like to write a magazine article and have it published someplace so we can explain how this works, why it works, and the results we're getting, and then they'll get off my back. They'll get off my case, and I can go ahead and practice medicine." Seemed like a rational thing. So I said, "Well, John, I'll give it a try, but you're telling me that there are people in the medical establishment, there are people out there who are consciously holding back a control for cancer?" I said, "That's impossible. Who are they, John, that would do such a thing?" And with the asking of that question, "Who are they, John?" That was the first question and a whole series of many questions to follow that led me on an amazing path of discovery. I thought what I would do is just spend maybe a few weeks looking over John's notes and maybe doing a little independent research. We'd write a magazine article or produce a film strip or something like that, and we'd explain what's going on and blow away the opposition, and that would be the end of it. Little did I know the voltage in the wire that I was about to grab hold of. The voltage in the medical wire, the treatment of cancer, the amount of money involved in all of this, the prestige, the reputations, the momentum of the whole cancer industry was so huge, and I had no inkling of it when I stepped into that circle with John to see what I could do to help him. But with the asking of that question, "Who are they, John?" that was the beginning of a journey that I'm still on, by the way. I'm still finding the answer to that question, and it's an amazing story, and I'm going to share some of it with you today. Now, I've got to condense all this down, so let me move right ahead. You know, they say you're supposed to condense, get it short so people can remember it and understand it. So I've decided to condense this whole story of the science and the politics, both, into 35 words so we can have an early lunch. Good. Yes, that's what I would say if I was sitting out there, too. 35 words. Here it is. A control for cancer is known, and it comes from nature, but it is not widely available to the public because it cannot be patented, and therefore is not commercially attractive to the pharmaceutical industry. Now, there in 35 words is everything that you really need to know about this topic, if you really understand what that means. Now, that concludes my primary presentation. With the time that remains, I'll just cover a few spattering of remaining details. Let's overview the science of cancer therapy. There are two views of cancer out there, the orthodox view and the alternative view, or the view that Dr. John had, and the view that I have, and the view that many doctors now have who have taken a deeper look at this and have abandoned the principles of orthodox therapy. The orthodox view is that cancer is a lump or a bump. It is a growth. And therefore, if that is the cancer, obviously the solution to cancer is to get rid of the lump or the bump. Cut it out, burn it away, or poison it. Get rid of it. That's the cancer. And so you go to the orthodox physician and they'll cut it out or burn it away or poison it away and they'll say, we got it all. Often, as you know, however, it comes back, so they didn't get it all. That's the orthodox view. The alternative view is that the lump or the bump is not the cancer at all. It's the symptom of the cancer. The question is, what caused the lump or the bump to grow? What is it in the metabolism of the body that causes that lump or bump to grow? And so, instead of looking at symptoms, the alternative physician will look at causes. And he will say that there's something wrong with the balance, the natural balance, the homeostasis of the body. Something is wrong that causes that lump or bump to grow, and that's what we're going to attack, not the lump itself. And so the orthodox physician wants to get rid of the lump, the alternative physician wants to get rid of the cause of the lump, and to a large extent will even ignore the lump or the bump, much to the dismay of the patient who's been taught to think that that's the cancer. Now, sometimes the alternative physician will remove the lump because of cosmetic reasons or because it's life-threatening. If it's growing near an artery or if it's blocking passage of the intestinal tract or something like that, it's got to be removed, but not because it's a lump, but because it's life-threatening regarding its location. And so they will get rid of the lump under those conditions, but otherwise they pretty much ignore it and say, well, it'll be gradually reabsorbed by the system over time, and if it's not, it'll be benign anyway. You see, most of those lumps and bumps, if you look at them under the microscope, are not pure cancer. Most of them are relatively small percentage of cancer. Most of those tissues that the doctors are concerned about eliminating are non-cancerous. Only the most virulent forms of cancer are all cancer. And so you have this mixture between cancer and non-cancer. And it's possible, let's say, to use radiation, and you can radiate the tumor, and incidentally, the cancer part of that tumor is more resistant to radiation than the non-cancerous part. So let's say if you have a tumor that's 80% non-cancerous and 20% cancerous, which is a fairly typical ratio, you can get rid of 80% of it, and the patient and the doctor are deliriously happy. Look, we've shrunk this tumor by 80%. But all they've done is gotten rid of the non-cancerous part. The remaining 20% is pure cancer now, and it spreads. So this focus on the tumor has some serious problems to it. So anyway, I'm a little bit off the track. That is one of the ways of distinguishing the two views between the orthodox and the alternative view of cancer. Now, to simplify this, we may think of cancer as the healing process gone out of control. I mean, if it weren't for the body's ability to repair itself and to produce new tissue constantly, we'd be in pretty bad shape, because that's a natural part of our life cycle. On an average, I've been told that the average cell lives about 7 years. Some live longer, some live shorter. So the average is about 7. So every cell in our body on an average has been replaced every 7 years. That explains my loss of memory, I keep telling Pat. Don't blame me, it's just my body. But actually it's true, the brain, by the way, does not replace itself. That's one of those cells that stays on and on and on. But most of the cells do replace themselves on an average of every seven years. So if I were to scratch my hand just like this, what I've done is scraped away a few skin cells. Already, my body is starting a process to replace those skin cells with new cells. That's a natural part of the healing process. When those skin cells are replaced, there are signals, both chemical and electrical, that tell the system, you've done your job, you can stop now, and it works just fine. However, if our chemical and electrical signals are out of whack, then this healing process may not stop. And it will continue to heal and heal and overheal. First thing you know, I've got a growth on my hand. And I go to the doctor and he says, cancer, let's cut it off. But the cause of it is the breakdown in the chemical and the electrical systems that were supposed to tell my body to stop healing. Now that's kind of an oversimplified but a fairly accurate view, a statement of the theory behind cancer that is held by most alternative doctors in this field. What are these electrical and chemical signals? We're going to focus this morning, because time requires we have to pick one. We can't pick them both. We're going to focus on the chemical side of it. The chemical signal is not the presence of a chemical, but the absence of a chemical, or several chemicals. In other words, what I'm saying is cancer is not caused by something. It is caused by the lack of something. For years, they thought that cancer, or let's go back to scurvy. They thought that scurvy was caused by some kind of a bacterium or a virus or some evil substance that lurked in the dark holds of ships. Of course, we now know it was the lack of vitamin C. It wasn't something, it was the lack of something. And you can go down the list with all kinds of chronic diseases, whether it's scurvy or pernicious anemia or so many of the chronic diseases of man. We now know it wasn't caused by something. It's caused by the lack of something. And we think that cancer is in exactly the same relationship. The lack of something. Well, what is this deficiency? What is it? Deficiency of what? Our view is that there are two primary deficiencies involved here. There are two factors. And the simplest way to identify them is to divide them into the intrinsic factor and the extrinsic factor. Intrinsic meaning it's something that arises from inside the body, that the body is supposed to produce itself. And the other is from outside the body. The extrinsic factor is something that comes in from the outer world. Both are necessary. There are others as well, but it has been the conclusion of the researchers in this field that these two that I'm going to mention are the primary ones. Now, the intrinsic factor, what comes from the body itself? Those are the proteolytic enzymes. The proteolytic enzymes are produced in the pancreas. They are the trypsin and the chymotrypsin, and a whole cluster of enzymes that are designed to digest protein, hence proteolytic enzymes, to digest protein. Well, what's that got to do with cancer? It has a lot to do with it, because it turns out that cancer cells have a protein coating around them which has a negative electrostatic charge. We're touching on the electrical side of this equation here for a moment. But these cells have an electrical charge around them carried by this protein coating, and it's negative. The immune system also is negative. All of those immune factors, you know, the the monocytes, leukocytes, lymphocytes, all those other sites running around there, they're all negative. And we need them to fight against things that are alien to the body. And one of the mysteries has always been, why is it that the immune system does not attack and destroy cancer cells? Isn't that foreign to the body? Well, no, it's not foreign to the body, actually. As I mentioned a moment ago, it's part of the healing process. So it's not foreign at all. But secondly, the cancer cells, when they get out of control, when they're no longer just healing cells, but they become what we call cancer cells, they develop this protein coating, and they take on a negative electrostatic charge. Now, we know that like charges repel each other. So negative charges repel each other. Therefore, the cancer cell with its negative charge repels the white blood cells with their negative charge, and so it's well protected from the immune system. How do you get rid of that protein coating? You digest it with proteolytic enzymes. The body is supposed to produce enough leftover proteolytic enzymes to take care of this if necessary. Now, most of those enzymes are used in the digestion in your intestinal tract, the digestion of protein, particularly animal protein. Red meat takes a lot of it. And isn't it interesting that we find that heavy meat eaters have a much higher incidence of cancer than those who do not eat a lot of meat? Isn't it interesting that diabetics who have a weak pancreas have a much higher incidence of cancer than non-diabetics? Isn't it interesting that those who come from a hereditary strain where the pancreas is weak, it's passed down from generation to generation, have a much higher rate of cancer than those, than other people? And we say, well, that's the hereditary factor of cancer. In a way, it is. But it's all traceable to the pancreas and the production of the proteolytic enzymes. And so one of the first things that a doctor will do who is following this theory is to take his patient off of meat and all dairy products. And that's why this vegetarian or vegan diet comes into play. It's not just a fad. There's a reason behind it. Now, some patients say that I can't do that. No way. I'm going to give up my meat and my cheese. And they don't do too well under therapy. But if a person is fighting for their life, they'll say, hey, that's an easy thing to give up. And you'd be surprised at the results. My wife will tell you about those results if you want to ask her about them, because they're amazingly good. But you have to give up the meat. So that is the intrinsic factor. What about the extrinsic factor? Well, now we're talking about laetrile. That's something that comes from outside. It comes from food. And so we call it the food factor. What is this food factor? When it's found in nature, it's called amygdalin. That's the chemical name of it. It's been known for a long time, from the turn of the century. You can look it up in some old chemistry books. Amygdalin is well-defined and well-known. But it wasn't used in the treatment of cancer until fairly recently. Amygdalin, in its purified and concentrated form, which is used in the treatment of clinical cancer, is called laetrile. It's basically the same substance. Well, what is it? It's a molecule. It has four components. Two of them are glucose, or sugar. One of them, for those of you who are taking notes, is cyanide. Don't forget to put that down. Cyanide will scare the devil out of you. And the other one is benzaldehyde. Now, that scares people. Cyanide. You mean you're recommending that I take cyanide? It could kill me, won't it? Well, we have a very funny view of cyanide. Yeah, cyanide is deadly poisonous in its gaseous or nascent form, and they do kill people with it. They execute them with cyanide, and if you get some of it accidentally, you're in bad shape. But that's only in the free form, or the pure form of cyanide. Now, when cyanide is locked up in molecular form with other elements, then it's not cyanide anymore. It's cyano something else. And it's not necessarily toxic in that form. For example, vitamin B12 has cyanide in it. Did you know that? It's called cyanocobalamin. It's loaded with cyanide. But we would be dead without it. So in a way, you could say that cyanide is an essential nutrient for life in the proper form, but not in the gaseous form. So we're talking about cyanide in a molecule that is not gaseous at all, but it's locked up with benzaldehyde and it's locked up with glucose. And it's not cyanide, it's amygdalin. Now, the question really is, how does it work, or theoretically at least, how do we think it works in the treatment of cancer? And it's very simple. If you could release the cyanide at the cancer cell, wouldn't that be nifty? And not release it anywhere else? You've got this molecule, and if you're eating foods rich in this substance, amygdalin, it's in your food, and it's going through your bloodstream, and it's covering your whole body, and if it comes to a cancer cell, wouldn't it be great if you had some mechanism whereby you could give it a message and say, okay, dump your cyanide there. And that is exactly what happens. The only thing that will release that or unlock that molecule of amygdalin and release the cyanide and the benzaldehyde, which, by the way, is also toxic, the only thing that will release that is an enzyme, and it's called beta-glucosidase. In my book, I call it the unlocking enzyme. It's easier to remember. Because that's what it does. It's an unlocking enzyme. So that enzyme will release the cyanide and the benzaldehyde. Isn't it interesting that that enzyme is found in cancer cells? And only in cancer cells. Amazing. It's an amazing a mechanism of nature that could not have been accidental. It was designed to be that way. It's part of the body's natural mechanism to control this healing process. It works fine as long as you're eating foods that are rich in this substance. The problem is that modern man has gotten rid of just about every food that contains it. Why? Because it has a bitter taste to it. If you've ever chewed an apple seed, which your grandmother may have told you, don't eat those things. If you've ever chewed an apple seed or an apricot seed, they're bitter. But what you are tasting is the effect of the benzaldehyde and the cyanide being released. That is where this comes from. So people say, ah, that's bitter, I don't want that. And so they select against foods like that in favor of sweeter foods and processed foods. And the more advanced civilization gets, and the more they refine their foods and have these delicate tasting foods, and getting rid of all of these bitter foods, the higher the cancer rate goes. It's as simple as that. It used to be in this country, I guess it's about 80 years ago now, that there was no such thing as a sweet almond. I mean, we think almonds today are always nice. They taste good. They're sweet. There's no amygdalin in a sweet almond. But the original almonds, what we now call the bitter almonds, which 80 years ago that's all there was, the bitter almonds, they were all bitter, that's a rich source of vitamin B17 or Laetrile or amygdalin, depending on what you want to call it. We've selected against these foods. You go to Northern California where they grow all these almond trees, and if you look about this far off the ground, you can see where the bark changes. They've all been grafted. The root is old bitter almond root tree. But from that point forward, they've grafted on twigs from the sweet almonds. And so we've gotten rid of that source. Lima beans used to have a little bit of amygdalin in them. And of course, even lima beans today aren't particularly good tasting, I don't think. But I guess 80 years ago, they were worse. Because they've been processed to get rid of that amygdalin. And you can go on and on and on. Foods have been deliberately made devoid of amygdalin. And as long as we continue to eat those foods, we're setting ourselves up for a real bad experience when the body starts to heal itself and then needs to stop healing itself. Now, that is kind of a quick overview of the intrinsic and the extrinsic factor. We could talk more about it, but I think that gives you a general idea of the science of cancer therapy. Thank you. The truth of the matter is, the science of cancer therapy is not nearly as complicated as the politics of cancer therapy. Because that's where it gets really nasty. That is the part of the story that I was completely unprepared for when I asked the question, who are they, John? And at first I couldn't believe it. This story led me, of all places, to Nazi Germany. I'll be talking about that in a little while. The reason for that is because pre-Nazi Germany, actually, was the origin of some of the world's greatest cartels in the pharmaceutical and chemical industries. And they came to the United States and they formed strategic partnerships with major pharmaceutical companies and other companies in the United States. And these cartels became a tremendously powerful and influential economic force in the field of medicine. And that's what I'd like to talk to you about today. The first thing that comes to mind when people hear the science of cancer is this. They say, well, if this is true, if what you say is true and it's that simple, how come my doctor doesn't know about it? I mean, he went to medical school. He's a very smart guy. And I've known his family for years. He's a wonderful, principled person. He wouldn't deliberately hold back at control for cancer. And indeed, he's not. So the question is, how come your doctor doesn't know about this? Or worse, how come your doctor tells you to run for your life, stay away from this because it's quackery, and he thinks he's doing you a favor by telling you that? Why is this? How did this come about? Now, in order to answer that question, we have to get a little background. In my book, World Without Cancer, I've documented, in fact, the whole major portion of the last half of the book is devoted to a documentation of the connection between the Rockefeller financial institutions and this cartel that I mentioned a moment ago called IG Farben. IG, I think, stands for Interessengemeinschaft or something like that. My German is non-existent, but it stands, I've been told, for a community of interest. It's translated into community of interest, Farben. Another way of saying community of interest would be cartel. That would be our word for it. So it's the Farben cartel that we're talking about. And Farben, it was the word that derived from the beginning of the whole chemical industry, which was dyestuffs. It all began with the creation of dyes. And from there it went into industrial chemicals, and from there it went into pharmaceuticals. And that's, of course, where it is today, to say nothing of munitions, which was sort of an offshoot of the whole thing. So you're talking about a tremendously large and financially powerful cartel that originated in Germany, but very quickly partnered with the Rockefeller Group in this country. I wish we had time to talk more about that, but they did form a very close partnership, even to the point where they themselves described it as a marriage. And they used the word very consciously. It was a marriage between Rockefeller and IG Farben. Now, Rockefeller has become very influential in the pharmaceutical industry, first in the United States and now around the world, but has chosen to remain pretty much behind the scenes. They know that it wouldn't look good to have the Rockefeller name popping up under all branches of industry. It's bad enough, they feel, that they're so well identified with the oil industry. How much worse it would be if they were also identified as being a dominant factor in the pharmaceutical industry. And so they consciously made the choice years ago to operate primarily behind street names and Swiss accounts and that kind of thing. But the influence can be shown, it can be proven, and it's very, very, very powerful. Now, you just have to sort of take my word for it at this point without looking at the documentation in the book. But you'll see traces of this coming up in the story I'm about to tell you. Let's pick up the story and see how these interests captured control of the American medical establishment. The mechanism that they used to do this was brilliant. They used the tax-exempt foundations. Most of the great tax-exempt foundations, of this country at least, were created by the same financial interests which have a powerful influence in the pharmaceutical industry. We're talking about the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, and people like that. And what they did is they used the tax-exempt foundation, some of which they created themselves, and some of which they took over, which is not too difficult to do if you have a lot of money. And the tactic, as I mentioned, was pioneered by Rockefeller and Carnegie. The reason they used the tax-exempt foundations was, there were three primary reasons. One was to improve their public image. At the time that this was all happening, there was kind of a public distaste for these tycoons. I mean, they were viewed as being ruthless. They had too much money for their own good. They were viewed as cruel and nasty people, and there was a lot of envy. And so they called together their public relations people and said, we've got to deal with this. So they started a campaign to do philanthropy. They figured if you can give away money for public causes, and these causes are viewed as good, why then people will like you. And so they hired newspaper people and foundation people, and they planted a lot of stories, made sure the American public was well aware every time they donated a grant to a hospital or to a library or something like that. Got a lot of publicity. Got their name across the top of the door. And then they developed a particular style, which was advanced by a fellow by the name of Gates, who went to work for Carnegie. Previously, he had worked for Pillsbury. And he developed what was jokingly called the Pillsbury formula for making bread. Well, it was not the kind of bread that Pillsbury made. It was the kind of bread you spend, you know. He says, we used to call it in school. That was bread. You got any bread, man? You know? It was that kind of a bread. And the formula was this. For Pillsbury, who had a particularly bad reputation in the community, this fellow Gates said, look, Mr. Pillsbury, let's go into the community and we'll do something called matching funds. You will put up $1 for every dollar that can be raised by the citizens themselves in the community for this hospital or for this library. He said, now the advantage of that is you get a lot of people working with you when they view themselves as on your team. And so they're out there raising money and they're mentioning your name. Every time they raise a buck, they're mentioning your name and they become your publicity agents in a way. And they have an affinity to you because now they're working with you. And so you have all of these people working for free for you, raising money, and you only put up half the money that you would have ordinarily. So this way you still get your name across the top of the door of the library, but it only costs you half as much money, and you've got all this good publicity besides. That was the Pillsbury formula. Rockefeller saw that, and he hired Gates immediately. He says, you've got to come and work for me, and he did. So this fellow Gates was largely the genius behind so much of this strategy. And it's what they called efficiency in philanthropy. That was their phrase for it. How to give away money efficiently. Meaning, how do you get back money? How do you get back more than what you give away? This has been the stratagem that has been used by so many of these people for many years, and the public has not really been aware of it. It's certainly true in the field of pharmaceutical research, which is, we're coming to that now. So now, for each dollar donated, you get back at least $2 and more in profits, and that's efficiency in philanthropy. Now let's put that into focus in terms of cancer research. The takeover of the medical industry was accomplished by the takeover of the medical schools, and this was done with efficiency in philanthropy. Before 1910, the state of medicine, or the practice of medicine in America, was quite mixed. There were a lot of excellent doctors, a lot of excellent institutions, and there was a mix of homeopathic doctors and allopathic doctors and chiropractic doctors and doctors of all different schools of thought. Many of them were excellent, but some of them were quacks. Some of them had no training whatsoever, and it was easy to get a certificate to put on your wall. There were literally diploma mills. You could write in, and for a few dollars, you could get a diploma, and you could be a doctor. And so there was a lot of abuse going on in the medical field at that time. And the public was aware of it. Congress was aware of it. Everybody wanted to do something about it. But what are you going to do about it? Well, the people that we're talking about, Rockefeller and Carnegie in particular, came to the picture and said, we will put up money. We will solve the problem. And so they hired a fellow by the name of Abraham Flexner. And in 1910, Flexner produced what was called the Flexner Report, which was widely circulated, in which he identified the problems and the weaknesses in American medicine and suggested that the schools of this country be completely made over and the standards be increased and that the funding be increased. And this was the solution, money, of course. Then the people who paid for Flexner to do this report offered the money. They offered tremendous amounts of money to the schools that would agree to cooperate with them. What did they ask? Not very much, really. They had what they called a triumvirate, three men primarily. There was Abraham Flexner, his brother, Simon Flexner, and Fred Gates. He was the one I mentioned before, who was the mastermind behind the strategy. Those three men, called the triumvirate, the donors said to the schools, we're giving you all this money. Now, would it be too much to ask if we could put some of our people on your board of directors to see that our money is being spent wisely? Well, when somebody's offering a starving school, a struggling school, a couple of $1 million, and all they ask in return is that some very well-known and prestigious individuals be added to your board of directors, the answer in many cases is yes, we'd be honored to have these people on our board of directors. Almost overnight, all of the major universities, which we now consider to be major universities in the field of medicine, received large grants from these sources and also accepted one, two, or three of these people that I mentioned on their board of directors, and the schools literally were taken over by the financial interests that put up the money. Now, what happened as a result of that is that the schools did receive an infusion of money. They were able to build new buildings. They were able to add expensive equipment to their laboratories. They were able to hire top-notch teachers. They were able to upgrade the level of medical education in America by 100-fold. But at the same time as doing that, they skewed the whole thing in the direction of pharmaceutical drugs. That was the efficiency in philanthropy. The doctors from that point forward in history would be taught pharmaceutical drugs. Those schools that did not accept those terms did not receive the money, and they generally fell by the wayside, and today you probably have never heard of them. All of the great teaching institutions in America were captured by the pharmaceutical interest in this fashion, and it's amazing how little money it really took to do it. So now the average doctor goes through school, he gets a great education, he has to be really smart to get through it. He learns all about drugs. He doesn't know too much about basic nutrition. I found that the average wife of these physicians knows more about nutrition than he does. But they sure know their drugs. And if you go to your typical doctor today, I don't care what it is, chances are you're going to walk out of there with a prescription. Why? Because that's what he has been trained to do. Drugs are the treatment of choice. Now, this is how it came to pass, ladies and gentlemen, and you need to know it. our doctors need to know it. And interestingly enough, a lot of doctors are becoming aware of that now. And we're seeing, I think, what is the beginning of a mass exodus, or at least a rebellion, of young doctors who have gone through this process, and they see what pharmaceutical drugs are doing to their patients. They see that they're not helping, and that they see that they're causing more problems than they're curing, and they are rebelling, and they're beginning to ask questions. But we have a long, long way to go. Now, how does this play out in Laetrile? The classic example, between 1972 and 1977, Laetrile was in the news. And there was a lot of hoopla, largely brought about as a result of the work that I was doing, and that Dr. John was doing, and that Patricia was doing. And we had a militant organization. We were out there beating the pavement and sounding the alarm and giving testimony before a lot of state legislative committees and all that. We were making a lot of noise, and so we were in the press. Some of it not too favorable, I have to admit, but we were in the press. And so the question came, does Laetrile work or doesn't it? Come on, let's get on with it. Let's find out. Let's find some nice, prestigious place, some research institution that we can trust, that will tell us whether Laetrile works or not. And what would be a better place than Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York on Manhattan? Now, everybody knows that the Memorial Sloan Cancer Center is at the top of the list of prestige. So, naturally, that was selected. And here's what happened. They began a series of tests on Laetrile, and they turned it over to their top laboratory technician, Dr. Kinematsu Segura, Japanese fellow. He was sort of at the end of his career. He was very well known, very held in high esteem by all of his associates. He was Mr. Laboratory Test. Whatever Segura said went for everybody. So they gave it to Segura. Segura ran his tests, and this was his report. He came to five conclusions. First of all, he said it improved the general health of the mice that he was using. Secondly, it appeared to relieve their pain. Thirdly, it inhibited the growth of tumors. Fourth, it stopped the spread of tumors. And five, it acted as a cancer prevention. That was his official finding. And at the end of this report, this is a quote, Dr. Segura has never observed complete regression of these tumors in all his cosmic experience with other chemotherapeutic agents, end quote. Astounding good report card, wouldn't you say? So what happened? To appreciate what happened next, we must understand that John D. Rockefeller Sr. and his son, J.D. the second, began donating money to Sloan Kettering in 1927, and in the 1930s they donated the block of land on which Sloan Kettering now stands. At the time of the Laetrile trials, there were three Rockefellers on the board of directors, James, Lawrence, and William. And they were there, of course, to see to it that there was efficiency in their philanthropy. So here's what happened. Segura's findings did not please the board of directors. Why? Because they were not interested in a cure for cancer that cannot be patented. Anything that comes from nature cannot be patented. They're not interested in that. But what they are interested in, finding something perhaps within something in nature, that they can find some subcomponent that they can extract and then make it a man-made chemical that works the same way, then they can patent that, then they're interested, but not if it comes from nature, and it doesn't make any difference whether it works. Now, how do we know this? Congressman John Kelsley used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain a board a copy of the minutes of the Board of Directors of Sloan Kettering, dated July 2, 1974. And from the minutes it said, quote, Sloan Kettering is not enthusiastic about studying amygdalin, but would like to study cyanide-releasing drugs, end quote. Now, if you understand that sentence, you understand everything that I'm talking to you about today. Not interested in amygdalin, because that's in nature. But if we can find a drug, meaning a man-made patentable drug, that works the same way, we're interested. Count us in. All right. So, we translate that into the real world of FDA approval. You know, the FDA now requires all of these substances to be used in the treatment of any disease to go through a rigorous testing process. We've all heard that. I've forgotten the number. It goes up every month. I guess it's $20 million or more, maybe much more, for the average drug to get processed and tested, and they test it for efficiency, efficacy, and safety. Well, who is going to spend $20 million testing the safety and efficacy of an apricot seed? You can't patent it. It's just money down the drain. Surely these drug companies aren't going to spend $20 million or more testing any substance from nature because it can't be patented. That, and of course the FDA says it's illegal to use unless it's been tested for efficacy and safety. Now you see the catch-22 you're in there. Nothing from nature, regardless of how effective it might be, will ever be proven safe or effective according to the FDA. It'll never be. Because nobody's going to spend the money to go through the test. So therefore, everything from nature will always be condemned by the FDA as unproven. An unproven cancer cure, which is the label they tried to hang on Laetril. It was, indeed, unproven in terms of FDA testing, but it was very well proven in the clinics and in the hospitals and in the laboratories of the people who were using it with a serious intent. So let's go back to Sloan Kettering, see what happened. Dr. Segura was pulled off the project. They said he must have made a mistake. And so they gave it to another group to test. It was Drs. Elizabeth Stockett and Lloyd Schlone. And they came up with essentially the same results as Segura did. In fact, in some ways, they were even more favorable. So they were pulled off the project, too. They must have made a mistake. Now, their reports were never released to the public. We do have them, by the way, but they were buried. At the time, they were not released. The only way we know about them is because they were later leaked by people inside Sloan Kettering who were highly incensed at what was going on. Finally, the tests were given to Dr. Franz Schmidt, and the results confirmed Segura's findings. But these were not released either. Schmidt was told to remain silent. The tests were finally turned over to a Dr. Daniel Martin at the Catholic Medical Center, not even in Sloan Kettering. And he was told, see what you can do with this. And finally, the test showed that Laetril had no appreciable effect on the treatment of cancer. Now, I got a little bit ahead of myself because there was a little niche in there. The first trial at the Catholic Center was aborted. You're going to love this. It was aborted because Dr. Segura, who was invited to be an observer, he had nothing to do with the tests, but he was invited to be an observer, said, oh, I know which, it was supposed to be a double-blind test, right? Nobody knows which mice are receiving the salt water injections, the saline injections, and which ones are getting the Laetril. He looked at him, he says, oh, I know which ones. He says, the healthy ones are the ones getting the Laetril. And it was true. And they said, oh, well, he guessed. Now it's no longer a double-blind study, so they canceled it, and they got Segura out of there. And they went into it for one last time, this time without Segura around. They came up finally with the test they were looking for. Laetril had no appreciable effect on cancer. Now, this test in itself, I'm giving you more details than perhaps you want, but I think these are very revealing. The test was obviously rigged. It was rigged for failure. And how we know that is that the mice receiving the placebo or the saline injection had their tumors stop growing, it said in the report, 40% of the time. That's impossible. If that were true, then salt water is the cure we're all looking for. How could they do that? And it was so obviously false. Well, they did it because the Laetrile mice were getting recovery at 40%, and they wanted to show that there was no difference between the two groups. So they could honestly say at the end, there's no difference. Laetrile doesn't show any appreciable improvement over the tests, over the controls. And so they had to resort to that weird and absurd statement that saline solution reduced tumor growth in 40% of the mice. And nobody, hardly anybody, ever dug into the report itself to read the details. They just looked at the conclusion at the front cover of the report, which said, Laetrile doesn't work. That's all they wanted to read. All right. Now that is the report that Sloan Kettering finally released to the world. Dr. Lewis Thomas, the president of Sloan Kettering, told the press, quote, there is not a particle of scientific evidence to suggest that Laetrile possesses any anti-cancer properties at all, end quote. See, these people lie. And they're lying on a topic that affects your life and the lives of your family. And they're lying. And we honor them in great dinners. We call them sir. And they're murderers. At this press conference, Dr. Segura was standing in the back of the room. He was told not to say anything. He was just to be there, to look good. And one of the newspaper reporters spotted him and he said, Dr. Segura, your early tests said that Laetrile was very effective. Do you still stick by those conclusions? And Segura said, I stick. That was all he could say. All right. There you have it. I call it genocide in Manhattan. So who are they, John? I've given you a few names, just a few of them. They're all over the place. Now, let me hasten to point out that this does not necessarily mean, in fact, it does not mean at all, that most of these, or even many of these people, are conspirators who are trying to keep a control for cancer away from mankind. It's the profit motive, ladies and gentlemen. It's not that they're trying to kill people, literally. They are killing people. But that's not their motive. Their motive is to make a buck. Their motive is to ignore anything that's competition to making a buck. And in that process of ignoring something from nature, it's causing unimaginable human suffering and death. We know that they're not doing this consciously because they themselves are victims. They fall to cancer and their families fall to cancer just like everyone else. So obviously if they knew or felt that this was an effective treatment, they would be using it, and they're not. In fact, the average doctor has a higher cancer rate than anybody else, any other occupation you can imagine, except possibly somebody working constantly around X-ray equipment. So we know that this is not a conspiracy to kill people. It does mean that vested interests have captured our medical system and caused it to be biased in favor of drugs. It does mean that the bias has been written into our laws and now prevents you and me from having freedom of choice to seek alternative cancer therapies. It does mean that those who have done this are also victims of their own bias. And it most assuredly means that we had better do something about it. With that, I'll close it off, and if there is time for questions, I'd be happy to do so. Thank you for listening. question was, do I feel that the creation of the pharmaceutical industry is pretty much the same as the creation of the Federal Reserve System? And the answer is no, because the Federal Reserve System was created specifically as a cartel. It started out to do exactly what it is now doing. It was conceived that way, whereas the pharmaceutical industry rather grew over a period of decades and became that. Now, the important thing is that they both are today the same thing. But they weren't conceived that way, in my view. But they both today are cartels, and they both have the power of government behind them, because they've had, the cartel members have had a lot of political influence and have been able to literally buy legislation which gives favoritism to the members of the cartel. So it's a marriage between the commercial interests and the cartel and government interests. And it's really bad for America. Does laetrile exist in other foods? Other foods other than apricot seeds and apple seeds? Yes. In fact, it exists in about 1,400 edible plants. They're ubiquitous in nature, but as I mentioned before, modern man is selected against all of them. Now, grasses are a very common source of amygdalin. All the broad grasses, the tunas grass, the arrow grass, and the broad leaf grasses are particularly rich. I think wheatgrass has a little bit in it, not as much as some of the broad grasses. But it's one of the clues in the early days of this was the fact that farmers in the Midwest would notice that during the wintertime their cattle would develop what they call winter cancers, the cancers of the ear or the tongue or something, and they'd go away in the spring. And they couldn't understand this, and they noticed that they start going away just about the time that the snow began to melt and the first grasses came up through the snow, and when the cows started to eat those grasses, the tumors would go away. And that was a clue, you see. Yes, it's in about 1,400 edible plants. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you phrased it as a philosophical question. I guess that's really what it is. I think human nature has two sides to it. And I think that when you have a political system or a social system which allows power to be concentrated into the hands of people without being responsible for that power, it tends to corrupt them. It tends to bring out that negative side of their human nature. That's the reason I am a firm advocate of individualism as opposed to collectivism. Individualism places responsibility on the individual, and the collectivism, of course, places all responsibility and power on the group, which translates into somebody representing the group, which translates the strong leader, and so forth. We have all the various forms of collectivism, which are communism, Nazism, fascism. All of these isms are merely variants of collectivism. Anybody that's given power, whether the power is derived by conquest of arms, which was the old-fashioned way, or whether it's derived by consent of the governed through elections and propaganda and economic pressures and rewards and so forth, which is the new way. Either way, when power concentrates into the hands of a few people or one man, it's a very corrupting influence. I don't think we can ever look for a system where we have to say, I hope we only get good men in there. I think we have to follow Jefferson's advice and look for bad men, or not look for them, but anticipate that they will be there. If you remember, Jefferson received a letter from one of his constituents, and he said, Mr. Jefferson, this is right after the Constitution had been drafted, he said, how can we be sure that only good men will be elected to government? And Jefferson's answer was irate. He said, speak to me not of good men. Rather, let us bind men down with the chains of the Constitution. The message was clear, that you have to count on scoundrels gravitating into political office. Don't build a system that requires only good men and saints to be there, because you've made a huge mistake if you do that. So this, I'm getting finally to your answer. My philosophical answer to your question is, I think all people are susceptible of being corrupted by power. And Therefore, our solution is not just to find new people to replace the ones that have the power, but to redesign the system and put it back to the roots that we had in this country, a constitutional republic with limited powers in the government. If we can do that, then these people will still be there, but they won't have any ability to do as much damage as they have. Electronic voting is a terrible idea because there are so many ways for it to be rigged, and the average person would never have any idea. Even a computer programmer wouldn't know if a election was being rigged under the system that's being developed right now. Yes, we produced a documentary film on that. It's called Invisible Ballots, and you can find the easiest way is to come to our website at Reality Zone. The Reality Zone is our commercial site where we sell books and video recordings and things like that. So it's www.realityzone.com, and you'll find the books that I'm talking about today. You'll find my book, Creature from Jekyll Island. You'll find the Invisible Ballots video and about 100 other titles on topics relating to this. I don't think that spreading the word by itself is sufficient. I think that's one of the problems that we have had and one of the errors I have made myself over my career in this field. For many years, I used to think that all we had to do was spread the word, sound the alarm, let people know, and somehow this would all go away. We just write letters to our congressmen, the people who have put us in this mess, and say, won't you please follow the rules? I actually believe that that was it. Now I've come fairly recently to a conclusion that that's necessary, but by itself, it's not going to accomplish any more results than we have already accomplished in the last 40-some years that I've been in the battle. What is the missing piece of the puzzle is the fact that we have never had the concept of coming to power. We've never had the concept of putting ourselves in the positions where we make the decisions. Instead of having to petition somebody who makes the decisions to do what we want, we've never thought that we should be in those positions. That was an idea that was totally alien. Most of us think, well, you know, politics is dirty. We don't want any part of that. I hate those politicians. You're not going to find me getting involved in that. And nobody wants to get involved in organizational work. We will go to meetings where everybody's in basic agreement, but who wants to go into an organization where people are not in basic agreement and try and get some friends together and go and try and turn that around? Well, you got to stick your jaw out and do a little confrontation with people now and then. We need to have influence in the power centers of society, which means all of the organizations and groups that have the power to lead people. We need to be in there providing and at least offering leadership. And that includes political action, but not only political action. So my answer to your question is, yes, we can continue doing exactly what we have, which is holding meetings, distributing books, producing video recordings, and getting them around, so forth. But unless we take that next step and have a plan where we can envision coming to power, and this may take a long time, it's not going to happen by the next election, but unless we have a long-range plan for that, it's all to no avail. And that is the reason that I created an organization called Freedom Force International, which is designed to do exactly that. And I hope you're curious on that, and add one more thing to your email list or your internet list, and look it up. It's Freedom Force International, all big one long word. FreedomForceInternational.org. And be prepared to spend a couple of hours there. I have looked at many alternative cancer therapies, and I find that amazingly high number of them do have amygdalin somewhere in them. And even if they don't, usually those therapies are in combination with a strict diet, and that means getting off of the meat. And that in itself can be a great asset for a cancer patient if nothing else is done. And in fact, you may find this statistic interesting, and then I think it's time to close this off. One of the events that I report on in World Without Cancer is a speech given by Hardin Jones. He's a he was an expert on statistics, and he was invited to speak at the American Cancer Society convention. And by the way, he'd been invited to speak there every year for a lot of years. He was their man. He was their statistician. And he said, I've been looking at the statistics for cancer recovery. And he said, I found that there's a lot of bias built into the statistics. For example, he said, a lot of the tests that you read about have a provision in them that if the patient doesn't complete the therapy, that their records are removed from the statistics. So that we're talking about only those who have completed the therapy. And that sounds rational at first, except if 70% of them die while undergoing the therapy, I say they should be in the statistics. But no, they're not. They're removed because they didn't complete their therapy, which means that the statistics for those that made it look a lot better than they really were. He said, there's another factor. He said, a lot of the institutions like Sloan Kettering and Mayo Clinic, they select their patients. They'll only take patients that they think have a fairly good chance of making it. The worst patients, they'll say, no, we can't do anything. So when they report their statistics, it's already selected against so that it's not an average cross-section of cancer patients. He said, I've gone down all these things, and I come to the conclusion that when you strip out all of these biases from the statistics, those patients who undergo no therapy whatsoever live longer than those that undergo therapy. And they never invited him back. And that is a fact. Just might keep that in mind. No therapy at all, according to this gentleman, is a better way to go than accepting orthodox therapy. Thank you very much.
Griffin is a writer and documentary film producer with many successful titles to his credit. Listed in Who's Who in America, he is well known because of his talent for researching difficult topics and presenting them in clear terms that all can understand. He has dealt with such diverse subjects as archaeology and ancient Earth history, the Federal Reserve System and international banking, terrorism, internal subversion, the history of taxation, U.S. foreign policy, the science and politics of cancer therapy, the Supreme Court, and the United Nations. His better-known works include The Creature from Jekyll Island, World Without Cancer, The Discovery of Noah's Ark, Moles in High Places, The Open Gates of Troy, No Place to Hide, The Capitalist Conspiracy, More Deadly Than War, The Grand Design, The Great Prison Break, and The Fearful Master. Mr. Griffin is a graduate of the University of Michigan, where he majored in speech and communications. He is a recipient of the coveted Telly Award for Excellence in Television Production, the creator of the Reality Zone Audio Archive, and is president of American Media, a publishing and video production company in Southern California. He has served on the board of directors of the National Health Federation and the International Association of Cancer Victims and Friends, and is founder and president of the Cancer Cure Foundation. He is the founder of the Coalition for Visible Ballots, a grassroots organization for the elimination of vote fraud that is made possible by electronic voting systems. He is founder and president of Freedom Force International,